Welcome to the podcast. As a listener, you're invited to claim your comp pass for our next live full-day Software Oasis virtual AI event with the world's top B2B AI experts. By attending, you'll join our engaged community of founders and executives from over 200,000 leading B2B global organizations. AI won't take your place, but a competitor leveraging it to drive results will. Learn the latest in AI first Thursday of every month. Tap green button at softwareoasis.com or use show notes link to secure your pass. I'd like to welcome everyone to this week's edition of the Consulting Spotlight. And today we're in for a real treat and an insightful conversation with Vygandas Plasas. He's the founder and CEO of CoreTip. So with that, I'd like to welcome you to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Michael. Hello, everyone. So as I was introduced, I'm founder of CoreTip. I have a services with executive consulting. I provide a fractional CTO service. I'm really happy to be here with you.
Yeah, it's really it's wonderful. I can see from some of the questions that have come in from the audience that we absolutely have a lot of people interested in your solutions. So I was hoping we could start off by having you share a little bit about your journey, you know, maybe how you got into the type of consulting that you're focusing on, and a little bit about what the services of CoreTip include.
Okay, how far back should I go?
As much as you think is relevant to help the audience understand your journey.
All right.
It's always interesting.
Okay, so my journey started from developer. So I was working on various large projects. Most of them were US-based projects, Germany-based projects. And I changed a couple of companies. And then one day decided that I'd like to work remotely. And then I switched to remote work, which is actually more challenging and requires way higher discipline, I'd say. So the journey started as a freelancer, as a contractor, and it happened that I really quickly jumped through steps of career, let's say, and became team lead, then became engineering manager, being in R&D manager's position, then CTO, fractional CTO, head of engineering, and so on. And when I was growing, I realized that this is how I can help companies, that I noticed a pattern of what I can really do well with those companies. And that was getting things right, fixing the process of engineering, of product management, how idea travels from stakeholder mind, maybe from the client, into product planning, into scoping, into designs, and then goes to engineers. That it gets developed and then released. So basically the full cycle. And then also I noticed that there's another service that I do practically every time with every client is finding proper people to join those teams that I'm actually fixing. So it is like executive consultancy, being like a fractional CTO, and also executive recruiter.
Wow, that sounds really exciting. It sounds like you're helping out at a lot of different levels and different organizations. And that makes me wonder, are a lot of the organizations that you're working in funded, pre-funded, Series A, Series B? Could it be anywhere along the way?
Usually it is a bit earlier stage, up to Series A. A lot of clients are SMBs that has another main line of business, and then they notice that they have a good tech that other people want, and they start building SaaS for B2Bs, and then, you know, some gets some issues, starts struggling a little bit, and then I come in and help them to streamline all of that.
Interesting. So it could be typically SMBs, but could be enterprise level
yes.
clients, maybe could. A division of their organization or something like that. So for the clients that you're working with, like, what are some of the most common challenges that you encounter when companies are transitioning from more of a agency model to an in-house development team or something on that idea?
Most common problem is that there are a lot of ideas. There is very long roadmap, and execs, stakeholders, comes up and are quite creative and wants everything yesterday. And that makes development team, product team, if there's any like that, to struggle a bit. There are sometimes that founder says, okay, now I need this. And next day they say, now I need another thing. And then after a week, so where's the first thing?
It's yeah.
like a circle of doom,
Managing the priorities and the expectations, right?
Yes. And then, there are some people missing. There are some people, let's say, there are some great developers and they are placed into head of engineering position. And they are not used to, let's say, manage engineering managers. They are not used to manage team leads. They don't know how to train them, what to advise them, because those guys has directly managed people, and they are having their own issues. And, so the higher you are, the worse problems you get to solve. Because if you get notification, that it's usually something bad. Because if it's easy, it gets solved at individual contributor level or like line manager level, But if it gets to you, it's something bad, really.
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense. And it's interesting how it is, it feels like such a unique journey for each organization, but the reality of it is a lot of these pain points and challenges are very common across organizations.
Oh, yes, it is.
Interesting. So how do you initially, as you start working with an organization, assess the company's technical maturity? And what is your approach to creating a roadmap for improvement along the way as you're working with these organizations?
I always start, I try to keep it simple. So I start with somebody who hired me and then who they're managing, and then I go down. So it depends how large the organization is, but on every level, people say different things. On product area, people say one kind of things, let's say, our developers not delivering properly, nobody's testing right, and so on. When you go to talk to engineers, then you get our product doesn't describe what we need to do, there are no requirements, and it's chaos, and so on. And you can even dive deeper, and then you start asking, let's say, team leads, so how what's up? Where are those problems coming from? What's your take on that? And our engineering manager doesn't train us. We don't know how to approach it. We don't know how to push back.
A lot of times it's really identifying the real root of the problem.
Yes, correct. And then you basically get all the problems. It's sometimes like 30-page report on all the findings, and diagnosis, what's probably an issue. And then I go back to stakeholders and discuss all of that. They read it, and we pinpoint what are the most effective low-hanging fruits, what are the more strategic issues that we need to fix. And basically, then I start preparing a plan how to fix it. And it again, involves iterations, like interviews with the same people. I present them options, what could be solved. I listen what's their take on those problems, how they see it. Maybe somebody will say, oh, that's not a problem. That's a problem. So, there might be some new things coming up. And basically iterate, and talk with everybody and get the overall vibe and try to get to the root cause.
Obviously, that's important, because you can't move forward on fixing things if you don't know what the real problems are. So that definitely sounds like the correct first step. So it sounds like over the years you've worked with a whole range of clients, and I'm sure you've had some successful outcomes, some not so successful outcomes, and obviously you're always aiming for success. But I was hoping you could share with our listeners maybe an example of a client that you were working with that you're particularly proud of the outcome, and where they were at before and maybe after, and you know, successful or not successful, you know, whatever it is, but just maybe an example, just to give our listeners an example of what you actually do day in and day out.
Okay, of course. So I'm really proud of a client. They are still the client, so we work still, but on a bit lower capacity. Fortunately, unfortunately, I did my job well, and I'm not really needed that much anymore.
It happens.
Yeah, so the problem was that they had the budget. They had a couple of agencies hired. There was a head of engineering. There were some project managers. And the goals were to get things delivered, because they weren't, and the budget was burned. So, you know, it is quite a big company. They have the budget, but it was not used effectively. So I stepped in, worked with the head of engineering, worked with project managers, and basically switched from agency approach into in-house teams. So we changed who works how many hours. So there were some part-time key people. We switched them also to working to full-time. Worked a lot with head of engineering to get the guy into executive chair. So to start doing more strategic decisions, less coding, more teaching people how to approach problems, how to think about, you know, various problems, and let's say plan careers for those people, how to find potential leaders and get them into team lead positions to motivate everybody, and basically how to look for long game to get everybody trained on the product, on the problem area, so they would know what they're working on really well and would start coming up with ideas themselves and fix everything themselves. So it would become easy to everybody to work. And yeah, we achieved that, and they even spend less than on those agencies, and and they basically caught up with multiple years of debt of releases, and they fixed everything and continue doing all of that.
And, you know, the bottom line is, you know, that's what you're trying to achieve, is a dream outcome for the client. So, you know, obviously it may mean the end of your relationship with them, but obviously it's going to lead to, you know, positive referrals and the like in the years to come. So I think that's okay.
Door is always open. If, for example, if they would decide to scale, It would be probably safer to get some advice, which won't be that many hours, actually, but, you know, then to just get to the right direction, double-check some ideas, and then move forward.
Yeah, no, and that's great. I mean, I think that was a big part of, obviously, what I was hoping to hear. And so as far as, like, a methodology, do you have a particular, core methodology that you use for evaluating and optimizing existing engineering workflows, especially in companies with, I'd say, established but inefficient processes?
Mm-hmm. Well, first rule, never rush. Yeah. Because it scares people, it's dangerous. Don't rush any decision and don't start brainstorming when talking with somebody who hired you, because you might brainstorm incorrectly. Yeah, just don't guess. So with engineers, well, it depends what approach they chose. My usually a first question is to whoever gives tasks to them, what was your estimate and what's the result? Surprisingly, it is very rare that anyone would track the original assumptions versus how long it actually took, because as soon as it gets done, everybody switches to the new thing. But it's rare to get into retrospective and see, you know, how it was planned and how it was done. Maybe, you know, the planning is incorrect. That could be the reason. Maybe communication of where we're planning it to the upper stakeholders is incorrect. Of course, like engineering, there might be issues. You can check on GitHub. You can check pull requests. You need to make sure that the lead of those people is actually working with everybody and checking the pulse. What's the mood? How everybody feels? Are they not burned out? And they still, you know, knowing what they are working on, a lot of things.
Makes good sense. And, you know, obviously, some of these projects, I'm sure, you know, take quite some time from beginning to end. And well, I'm sure there are other projects that move along faster, you know, if they're very, very straightforward. How do you, as you're working in different organizations, how do you get buy-in from different individuals within the organization? How do you avoid getting resistance from individuals within the organization? Are there certain things that you find work better and not so well? Or,
well, I'd say it's unavoidable. Yeah. You'll get it more or less. I think, well, my approach is usually reach for consensus as much as possible with everybody involved, because, well, you need to ensure that everybody in the team understands what needs to be done and what's the goal, what are the benefits. Does it mean more work for them, or does it mean easier work for them? It depends. And if they are able to share their mind on the plan, it's easier to make the plan that business would achieve the goals and everybody would more or less, you know, not 100%, of course, would get also what they would expect.
Sure. No, and I think that makes a lot of sense, because obviously it's better to have allies than enemies, right? It's gonna help push things.
Usually forward. People sense that something's wrong, so yeah, they are aware. I try to, you know, keep everybody calm and, like, you know, we will fix it. Yeah. I just need your help.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. The other thing one question that we had coming in from a lot of listeners, so I'll share with you. What are your, I guess I would say, critical metrics that you recommend clients keep track of to measure the success of their development processes? And how do you help them implement these measurement tactics?
Success of development. So first, I usually tell everybody you need to count bugs to make sure to know how much issues you release into real world, and check defects, how many you capture before the release. How are you estimating and how much you put into the roadmap versus how much actually gets done in that same quarter? It would show how well you are planning and how well you actually understand what needs to be done and how long it would take. Also, you know, issues, defects, and a deviation from expected timelines would indicate potential issues into how all of the requirements are communicated, how it's landed from product side and stakeholders into engineering.
Got it. And that sounds fair. And are there, you know, systems that are suggested to measure some of this after things have come through the process? Or is it really just looking at the structure of the framework of how everything is being implemented?
So it's quite the big, I'd say, fix. It's not usually one person's performance update. It's, you know, multi-department, cross-functional people or teams, like organization. I think the best way to understand is if your stakeholder is smiling. Yep. They start smiling, you know, if the stress levels decreases, if people are less angry, it means, you know, you start to manage expectations, you start to understand each other better, you start to deliver faster, you make less mistakes, so your clients are happier also, so your support personnel is happier. You know, yeah. Everything starts to line up properly.
Well, so here's a question I missed that came earlier from where you were giving that example of the client. So one question that came in from the community, how do you approach knowledge transfer and documentation in your consulting engagements to ensure lasting impact after your involvement ends on a particular project?
Oh, good question. I usually...
That's why I went back to it. I thought it was great.
So usually it is in very bad condition when I start. You know, if it was good, it would be a good indicator that I might not have what to do there. My approach is maybe not that much oriented on the documentation itself. I'd focus more on, you know, getting the roadmap items properly described so we would know what was supposed to be done and what were the requirements. And I always try to reduce the risk and try to involve more people into knowing the domain, the functions of the product, so there wouldn't be no person who is only one who knows some specific areas. So it's not super convenient. It's a bit painful to switch people on some tasks. Of course, I'm talking about the relevant people, right. Let's say developers, but that gives you some protection into, you know, if somebody leaves, somebody gets ill, you know, anything could happen. So the knowledge stays, and if you backfill, there is somebody to at least lead the, you know, show the direction where to get started. So it's not like completely empty. For documentation, and agile environment, it's sometimes complicated to get it right. You know, one quarter it might be one structure, another quarter you might have another design's facelift. You know, it's again different. So high level roadmap descriptions, details in epics, you know, if you use Jira, you know, that kind of stuff, definitely. But writing help guides, not my area.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It makes sense. So I definitely wanted to come back to that. So the other thing I was wondering, so are there strategies you recommend for companies who are, I guess, struggling with transition to remote first development teams, particularly in terms of communications and collaboration?
Oh, yes. So if you go remote, it's fine. If you go on site, it's also fine. If you go hybrid, that's where you will get issues a lot. It's very easy to mess up things.
Yeah.
Now, I have a story. So I was working remotely and I was managing people who were in London in office. And they were key people that were leading other people that also I was managing. So it was a weird, you know, mix of remote and on-site team. And then we have meetings. It's like, you know, operating on quite strict regime on the calendar. We have like various synchronization calls, you know, all hands and planning and design reviews, all of that stuff. And then we have the meeting, but in the office, a boss comes and they grab the people, say, hey, let's go drink coffee or something like that. And you're like sitting here waiting, so somebody will show. No, not going to show. So you know, that starts to mess up a lot of your agenda.
Sure.
And, you know, they get back, they say, can we have a call? But you have another call scheduled, so can't really just drop those other people and, you know, get back to the original call. But if it's completely remote, the difference from the office is that you will never meet at the coffee machine, so you won't have any chit chats and you won't see the mood. So you need artificially have calls on the calendar. You need to have group calls, you need to have one-on-one calls, you need to have at least one call with group of people about for random things, let's say coffee break call for 30 minutes, something like that. And it has to be quite strict and it occupies a lot of the calendar. And it is harder, but if you get used to it, it's like you operate like this. It's been working remotely before it was popular before COVID, so kind of got used to it. But it is different. You need to be really methodical and you need to be strict. You should not allow anybody to start missing the calls. And I would really recommend to somehow make sure everybody's using the camera, so at least you see a bit of them.
Right. You know?
Because if people stop using the camera, like the communication, you know, gets kind of weird and it's not too good. But it's very doable. I specialize into building that kind of teams.
Yeah, so a lot of times the challenge is not a fully remote team or a fully on-site team, it's that hybrid.
Yep, and if somebody's used to have ad hoc meetings, let's say, talk and solve the problem. With a remote setup, you cannot just get it solved. It's very hard to just get on the call and figure it out. You need to plan for it.
Understood. So I guess I wanted to wrap up by asking you this. So obviously you've had extensive consulting experience over the years. What are the most overlooked aspects of scaling a SaaS product that companies should pay more attention to?
Most overlooked aspect of scaling. If the company gets funded, they start scaling faster. And at that moment, you need to be in a position where you have already figured out your blueprint.
Yeah, on so you have to have a plan before you start pouring money on an idea.
So you need to. So when the team is small, it probably could be a bit weird to have the roles like head of something, manager, you know, lead, more of something. But if you get used into the rhythm of that structure, on how you approach problems, how you make decisions, how you work with people, how you, you know, train those people, when you need to scale, it gets much easier because you already have the structure which works. You basically copy paste. So one, let's say, engineering manager can have 10 teams under them.
You know, it's very interesting because a couple episodes back we had the founding partner of Mendoza Ventures, Adrian Mendoza, on the podcast. And you know what was interesting to me, the whole world of venture capital and investment and angel financing and VC financing was a whole other world I was not familiar with. And you know, he explained how, you know, many angel investors will invest in an idea when it's still a concept and they haven't quite found product market fit. But you know, most VC firms really just want to work with solutions that have found product market fit, even if it's early, and where they can just invest additional capital to blow up an idea and get it scaled, you know. And I think that's that's where they fit best. And it sounds very similar to what you're describing there, because I think a lot of times, you know, if an organization has not found that product market fit and they try to scale too quickly, I think other kinds of bad things can happen. So I think it's really a matter of finding that perfect balance. Well,
I've seen a huge company hiring like crazy and nobody knows what's going on. You know, you join and you know, what I'm supposed to do. It's like, good luck, figure it out.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Vigandis, I really appreciate your taking the time out and the deep dive on consulting and everything that you're doing over there. And, you know, for any of our listeners that would like to get in touch with Vigandis or his team over at CoreTip, we'll leave a link in the show notes. And for anyone that would like to keep up to date with all of these episodes and the latest going on here at Software Oasis, you can subscribe to our biweekly newsletter at softwareoasis.com/subscribe. And thank you so much for joining us on the Software Consulting Spotlight today.
Thank you very much. It was a real pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to the Software Oasis Podcast Network with more than 200,000 listeners each month. You're invited to join our engaged community of B2B founders and executives at our next live full-day Software Oasis virtual AI event with the world's top B2B AI experts. Reserve your comp pass today, get ahead with real AI strategies, join the first Thursday of every month. Tap green button at softwareoasis.com or use show notes link to claim your spot today.